My name is Amy Esdorn, and I'm here at the Society of Petroleum Engineers Annual Technical Conference and Exhibition at the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston, Texas. Today is September 30th, 2015, and I'm speaking with Carl Montgomery. Carl, thank you for participating in this interview.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, well, let's begin. My first question is, how did you get involved in the industry?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. It kind of started back. I had a citizenship class when I was in the seventh grade, and I had a citizenship teacher, and they gave us an assignment of what we would be interested in for a career. And so I did some work at that time in the area of petroleum engineering. I lived in Wyoming, and Wyoming was had a lot of petroleum going on. So that was kind of the first time I became kind of aware of what a petroleum engineer was and what they did. And then the thing that kind of really got me into it was between my senior year when I graduated from high school until I went to college, my grandfather had a farm in the panhandle of Nebraska, and I went over to visit him. And there was a rig running up on the hill in the sand hills there. And my dad came over and said, "Come on, Carl, let's go." And I said, "Where are we going?" "We're going up this rig." So he put me in the car, and we drove up on top of the sand hill, and he says, "Go down and ask the driller for a job." So I walked down the hill and walked into the doghouse, and there was this big old driller down there, and he said, I want a job. I'm just out of high school, and I need a job." He says, "I'll see you in the morning." And that's the first job I had in the oil field. So I worked that summer as a roughneck on the Exeter number 17 up on top of the sand hills in Nebraska, and then went on to college. And so I did that, and actually I got my degree at that time in secondary education. I was a teacher. And at that time, it was the National Science Foundation. The Sputnik had gone up, and there was a lot of money available for going back for science. Anybody that had any interest at all in engineering or science or anything, they had these big scholarships. So I went back to college, and I was working on my master's degree, and then I was working on my PhD at Colorado School of Mines. And the professor had a field trip, and he took us on a well site, and they were doing a cement job. Dow Well was doing a cement job at that time, and a guy named Virg Schneidel was his name. I'll never forget him. He had a big beard, and he had tobacco juice running off of his chin. And I was watching the drillograph, trying to figure out how this thing worked in the drilling rig. And he came up to me and put his hand around me. He says, "Son, why don't you come to work for a good company?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he says, "Well, you come and interview me tomorrow." And he gave me a business card. At that time, I was married and had two kids, and we were broke. And so the next day, I went to see him. And next thing I knew, I was a junior engineer for Dow Well. And at that time, they had a junior engineering program that I went through. It was about a year program, and you had to learn how to run all of their equipment and run different kinds of jobs. And at the end of that termination of that year, I could run every piece of equipment that Dow Well had, and I was fracking wells. And they asked me what I wanted to do then, and I said, "Well, I would like to go work in the lab." So they had a research laboratory in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I went down and had an interview for that, and then that's the next thing I knew, I was in the research organization, and then that's where my career really took off. And I worked there for probably 13 years, and before I was done, I was the department manager. I had 65 people working for me, and then Schlumberger took over, and they shipped us all to the field. So I went to the field and worked for Schlumberger for a while. But that's how I got started. That's how it worked.
So what did you get your undergraduate degree in?
My undergraduate degree was actually in biochemistry.
Okay.
And then I went back and I was working on my master's degree. And then they had this grant to go back and petroleum engineer at Carroll School of Mines. And I was doing my research at that time on foam cement. And a guy named Kohlhaas, Dr. Professor Cal Kohlhaas was his name. And I was doing work on foam cement at that time. And that's when this thing happened with Virg Schneidel. And teaching school does not pay very well. And I went to work driving a truck for Dow Well, making $800 a month more than I was teaching school. So you kind of feel sorry for the teachers, you know, but they have such a huge impact on our children, and yet they're some of the poorest paid people in the world. I don't know. So that's how that happened.
And why did you want to go into the research lab?
Well, I've always been curious about things, and I wanted to be involved in innovation rather than just going out and executing the jobs and engineering the jobs. I wanted to have some influence on the future of the technology, and I thought the best place to do that would be in some kind of a research organization, and so that's why I went in there. And it was a great experience for me because The mentors, the people I had at that time, you know, they had, most of those guys had come out of the Second World War, and a lot of the industry, a lot of the technology that we were using was had been developed during the Second World War, you know, napalm for frac fluids, and the engines that we used for the frac trucks or trucks were all Allison aircraft engines that came out of P-38 fighter engines from World War II, and these guys had all been through the World War. So they had these stories, and I learned so much from those guys about technology and how to use technology and how you had to be very innovative to be able to take the leadership role in things. And so that's what I did. And I had a lot of fun doing that. I did that when I was at Dowell, and then when I left Dowell through Schlumberger, when I went to ARCO, I worked in their research. I was basically a staff engineer. And the same thing when I went to Phillips, I was working in their research labs, because when you work in the centralized unit like that, you're a staff engineer. My main job was to start up fields. So if ARCO or Phillips or ConocoPhillips had a new field that they wanted to start up, then they sent me there as a completion engineer to do that, because and each field kind of takes some innovation, some new learning, and some different ways to do things. And that's what I enjoy doing. And, you know, during my career, because I was working in research there, I've got about 32 patents I know numerous awards and things I've got because of that. So it was at that time it was a great decision. I didn't know whether it was going to be all right or not, but working in research really allowed me to advance my career and be able to get the technology development that has really made a big influence on the industry, I think. So,
well, speaking of some of those innovations, what were some of those innovations that you worked on?
Well, man, there's a lot of different things, you know. For example, electromagnetic energy. We did a lot of work on electromagnetic energy, on heating hot like geothermal wells. In fact, I sit on the President's Council for Geothermal Energy now, because geothermal energy, it comes out of a well, just like petroleum does, and all the completion techniques and the techniques for stimulation are applicable to geothermal wells. So I think, you know, I have several patents on that, on how to utilize energy other than just petroleum energy to power society. So that was important. I think the other thing is I hold the original patent on horizontal well fracturing. And one of the big things that's changed when horizontal wells, you know, the first horizontal well was drilled by the Russians back in 1932 sometime. And for years and years, we've always been taught that a horizontal well is infinitely conductive, and you don't need to fracture a horizontal well. But the thing that really has changed here in recent years, and all this shale play that we see going on these days, and the huge amount of fracturing that takes place, is all because of the marriage between horizontal well drilling and hydraulic fracturing. And interestingly enough, I hold the original patent on that kind of thing from years ago. That patent expired and it was gone. You know, Mitchell Energy did their work up around Dallas there that kind of kicked it off. And then today, all this shale work that we're doing on these unconventional sands all has to do with the marriage of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal well technology.
So tell me, how did that come about? I mean, what were you working on that sort of filed that patent for horizontal well fracturing? And
well, in my career where I had Dowell, I started off, it's an interesting story too, because I was working in mining chemicals, because my background was basically in the chemistry aspect. So I was working in mining chemicals and I was pretty successful at that. So they finally, after a while, they put me in charge of the fracturing lab, and they were just getting interested in geomechanics. And they'd hired this guy out of MIT to come in and set up a geomechanics lab, and the doggone guy quit. They had bought something like $2 million worth of rock mechanics equipment. This stuff was showing up on the doorstep of the laboratory. And the guy that had bought this equipment, who was a PhD in geomechanics out of MIT, had been hired by the Hanford site up in Washington to come up and figure out how to get rid of radioactive waste. So they did. All of a sudden, we had this big hole, so the manager came to me, the vice president, a guy named Pompelli, came to me, and he says, Carl, go figure out what all this stuff's for. So that's what I did. I went to the meetings. I met a couple of three guys, recruited them into Dowell, and we built this big rock mechanics facility. And so between doing that and then also doing research on fracturing fluids, I became very interested in how to optimize well productivity, and the marriage between horizontal wells just seemed like a logical marriage to me, because a horizontal well is nothing more than a subsurface manifold. And these fracture treatments you put in is basically substituting a vertical well for the horizontal is in a manifold that connects these many, many vertical wells together. And that seemed like a logical thing to do. And in fact, it is. That's why we're being so successful today. And the people that really first did that work was Maersk in the North Sea, where they started, they had long horizontal wells, and they were fracturing those wells in the Danian Chalk, and they were getting very successful results with that. And then Mitchell picked up their work that they started up in the unconventional shales, you know, around Dallas there. And today, you know, I don't know. Back when I first started, we were probably doing something like 1,500 frac jobs a month, you know, worldwide, and now we're probably there's 15,000 frac stages per month that are being completed in these wells, and it's all because of this huge change in technology, and it's had a major impact on the industry for sure.
And where what year was that around that you
that patent issued in about 1988, 89, something like that. Of course, those things have a 17-year life, so today, you know, that patent is all expired. And people didn't really take advantage of it like I thought they should have. But, you know, a lot of times when you get a patent, like I got a lot of patents from ARCO, it's basically a defensive thing. They do that so that they don't have to pay anybody else a royalty. Some companies take big advantages of patents. You know, they go out and they really enforce their patents, but a lot of companies basically get their patents in place as a defense so that they don't have to pay somebody else. And that's what most of my patents really, how they ended up was as a defense where they didn't have to pay anybody else on that. So I'd say that, you know, this horizontal well business and this electromagnetic stuff. I did a lot of work in very heavy oils. I had a patent at that time on being able to put electromagnetic heating elements in horizontal wells to heat up the oil to be able to drain it. And then there was some work that we did for gas hydrates. I was working in Alaska, and there's big gas hydrates up there where you would take a propant, the propant that we use in fracturing, and make it electrically conductive, put some carbon fibers in it, make it electrically conductive, and then use an induction heater to be able to melt the hydrates. It's interesting to me because we were looking at hydrates at that time, and now people are looking at it for oil shale. Same kind of thing, doing in situ heating of oil shale, using that same kind of idea of being able to heat things in situ like that. So I guess that's the major things I would say. It's kind of hard to say. I've got, you know, there's a lot of them. I had a lot of fun doing it. It was a great time.
What was your favorite project that you worked on?
Well, golly, that's hard. You know, I was working as a staff engineer both at ARCO and at ConocoPhillips. And what a staff engineer does, the position, I was a chief completion engineer kind of for those companies. And what I did is when we had new fields developed, new fields coming on, then I would just go to those fields and work on them. And I remember one of them was at Thumbs Long Beach. You know, Thumbs Long Beach was developed years and years ago, Texaco Humboldt Union Mobile Shell. That's what Thumbs stands for. They built these islands offshore. And for the Wilmington field, they had been producing those wells for many years, but the production decline was pretty rapid on them. So they asked me to come out, and we started a frac program. Well, we saved that field, basically, because they were down to about 25,000 barrels a day, and ARCO got involved in that, and when we started fracking those wells, we were able to get that production back up to about 70,000 barrels a day just by introducing the fracturing technology into that field. And that was a very rewarding thing is to be able to, we saved that field. In fact, it's still going on today. You know, after we started that field is still in production today because we were able to introduce that technology into it. I think the other one I had a lot of fun with was Russia. They sent me to Western Siberia. I spent about 6 months in Western Siberia with Lukoil, ARCO and Lukoil. Oh, no, it was ConocoPhillips and Lukoil had kind of a joint venture. ConocoPhillips had like 10% of Lukoil, and they have four oil fields in that area out there, a place called Kogolim. each of the oil fields has got more reserves in it than Prudhoe Bay does. 26 billion barrel oil reserves, and there's four of them. They're within probably 150 kilometers of each other. And they had been fracking those wells, and it's a long story about how that happens, but they weren't doing them very well. They were just basically just pumping a frack in them. And then the great thing about fracturing is that you can do a very lousy job, and it still works. So they asked me to come over, and I took those wells. The first well, I took it from the average production rate was like 50 cubes a day. Cubic meter is like six barrels, so times 50, that's about 300 barrels a day. And I fracked the first well, and it came in at 215 cubes a day. So that means I took four times the production for that one well. And they thought it was a fluke. So they gave me another one. It was the hardest well. They couldn't get it to frack, so I did that one. And at the end of the day, I did 15 wells, about three to four wells in each of those four fields, and the average production rate was about 250 cubes a day. And that they had, before that time, had been only making 50 cubes a day, and they were making like five times the production after we did those 15 wells. And that was a very rewarding thing. And we kind of turned that whole thing around for them. You know, the Russians are very analytical. They're very, very smart mathematically. But when it comes to actually going out in the field and doing it, their technology and the way they do it is somewhat left over from a long time ago, I would say. I don't know. I don't want to be critical about that. But I just know that the way that they were doing their work, there was a lot of, as we call it, low-hanging fruit to be picked. And it was really easy to do it. So those are the couple of the projects. You know, I've worked all over the world. I've worked actually in fracked wells in like 57 countries. So it's kind of hard to pick out which ones are more favorite. They're all interesting. You know, every project is interesting, but rock is the same. If I'm in Western Siberia, I'm working in Dubai. I mean, the rock's rock. It's just the good Lord, he put the oil in the worst places in the world, you know, in the desert and in the coldest places in the world, except for Thumbs. Thumbs was pretty nice. That was a beautiful island, like working in Hawaii or something.
That's great. So you mentioned Mitchell Energy, and I'm just curious, did you ever work with them, or when Bob Mitchell was out there working the shale and everything, I mean, everybody was kind of, I think, hesitant to think that anything was going to happen. What were you thinking? I mean, you'd done horizontal fracturing. Yeah.
Well, actually, I had not, you know, put the patent in it, but nobody ever did it. Mitchell, you know, he got the idea. He says, this is a good idea, and he went and did it. So I never worked for him or anything, but he had the idea, and he had the resources to be able to go out and do it, and there was nobody there to stop him. When you're working for a big company, you know, you come up with these ideas, but unless you're the guy out there, and that's one disadvantage of being a staff engineer. When you're working in the field, sometimes you can do things that maybe are not they're a little bit counterculture, is what I would say. And he did that. He went kind of against the rules, and the reservoir engineer said you never need to frack a horizontal well, never. You read the books. Joshi's book says that. You don't need to frack a horizontal well. Well, guess what? Mitchell did it. And he changed the industry when he did it. The marriage between hydraulic fracturing and horizontal wells has just made a huge impact on the industry. And I don't want to get into the politics or anything, but, you know, the United States does not really have a real strong energy. They don't have an energy policy. There is not one. And most people don't recognize this, but there's enough natural gas in the United States to last us for 300 years. Prudhoe Bay, Alaska has got a gas cap. They produce 9 BCF every day and reinject it in the gas cap, but there's no way to get it out. 9 BCF a day is enough gas to be able to supply half the consumption of the United States. In one oil field. One oil field does that. There's so much natural gas in the United States, it's just... it just boggles the mind, and yet everything is focused on other kinds of energies. I think renewable energy is great, but we're not, until, you know, the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, Mother Earth's always there, geothermal energy will always be there, which I think is the answer, but fossil fuels are going to be around for a long time, and why the United States doesn't take advantage of that. And for me, all I got to do is they got to pass a law that says we're going to put a methane or natural gas fuel spigot in every gas station in the United States. If you did that, the infrastructure is in place. It would take care of that. The CO2 footprint would go down. We'd increase the job market. we could become completely energy independent. We wouldn't have to worry about the Middle East anymore. Let those guys get in their fights or whatever they want to do. Just forget them. So that's what, anyway, I'm preaching here. I'm sorry.
So you were giving some advice there, but
yeah, I sure was. I'm sorry.
That's all right. My next question is, what was the best advice that you've been given and about working in the industry?
I was working for a guy named Jim Eastlack. He's great. He's a vice president of Oxy out in California, I think, now. He might be retired by now. He says, Carl, he says, you know, you work for two reasons. He says, you work to make money, which we all do that, and to have fun. And if you're not doing both, you need to change jobs. So that's the best advice I ever got. And so that's what I try to base my life on. If I'm not having fun doing a job, I need to do something different. Money is important, of course, to make a living and everything to support your family. And it was really important when I first went to work for the industry because I was so broke. But after a while, having fun with your job is the most important thing, you know, having fun and making money. So that's, Eastlack told me that, and I think that was great advice. So I try to follow that.
Well, we have a lot of students who are coming up and young professionals coming up in the industry. What, other than that advice, what advice would you give them?
Well, my dad, he was a philosopher also. He always told me, he says, Carl, he says, they hire you to solve problems, not to make problems. So my advice to young people to be successful is that when you come into an organization, you take all the responsibility they will give you. I mean, every ounce of responsibility. Anything they ask you to do, you take it and you do it. Even if you think that you ought to be paid more for it, don't say a thing about that. You just take the responsibility. You go do the job. Make your boss's job easier for him, and don't make any problems, and you will be successful. My dad told me that. He says, they hire you to solve problems, not to make problems. You know, a lot of times I see young people, well, why did he get a promotion and I didn't? Why has he got a bigger cubicle than I've got? That's what they think about, that kind of thing. That's not what you really, that's not why a company hires you. They hire you to make problems go away, not to make the problems. If you understand what I'm meaning, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my last question here is, how has being an SPE member affected your career?
Oh, man, tremendously. You know, I joined the SPE when I first went to work for Dowell in the lab. I had a boss at that time, and they pay for the SPE membership, and they say you need to be an SPE member. So I did. I signed up, and so that was, gosh, that was a long, long time ago. You know, so the SPE is really the knowledge sharing community for the oil industry. So if you want to know something, you go on One Petrol and you look and you see what's been done in the past. So that was, and then also from a career development standpoint, because I became a director for the local section there in Tulsa when I was working. That happened real quickly. So getting involved from the management to make sure that the SPE is an active, trying to be active in that, in the SPE organization has been great. And I'll tell you, the distinguished lecturer, they asked me to be a distinguished lecturer 1 year, and that experience was one of the highlights of my career. The SPE did that, you know, and that experience, when I did that, they sent me all over the world. I got to go places and meet people I'd never met before. And it all had to do because of the SPE. So I have to say that the SPE has provided the knowledge. Anytime I need anything, they've given me career opportunities, allowed me to interface. My whole network that I have is basically, they're all SPE members. So the whole career and your knowledge sharing business is due to the SPE. So that's what I would say about that.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for coming by and giving us this great interview.
You bet.